Chapter 6. We plowed along bravely for a week or more, and without any conflict of jurisdiction among the captains worth mentioning. The passengers soon learned to accommodate themselves to their new circumstances, and life in the ship became nearly as systematically monotonous as the routine of a barrack. I do not mean that it was dull, for it was not entirely so by any means, but there was a good deal of sameness about it. As is always the fashion at sea, the passengers shortly began to pick up sailor terms, a sign that they were beginning to feel at home. Half past six was no longer half past six to these pilgrims from New England, the South, and the Mississippi Valley. It was even bells. 8, 12, and 4 o'clock were eight bells. The captain did not take the longitude at 9 o'clock, but at 12 bells. They spoke glibly of the stir cabin, the orrard cabin, port and starboard, and the old castle. At 7 bells the first gong rang. At 8 there was breakfast, for such as were not too seasick to eat it. After that all the well people walked arm in arm up and down the long promenade deck, enjoying the fine summer mornings, and the seasick ones crawled out, and propped themselves up in the lee of the paddle boxes, and ate their dismal tea and toast, and looked wretched. From 11 o'clock until luncheon, and from luncheon until dinner at 6 in the evening, the employments and amusements were various. Some reading was done, and much smoking and sewing, though not by the same parties. There were the monsters of the deep, to be looked after and wondered at. Strange ships had to be scrutinized through opera glasses, and sage decisions arrived at concerning them. And more than that, everybody took a personal interest in seeing that the flag was run up, and politely dipped 3 times in response to the salutes of those strangers. In the smoking room there were always parties of gentlemen playing euchre, draughts and dominoes, especially dominoes, that delightfully harmless game. And down on the main deck, forward of the chicken coops and the cattle, we had what was called horse billiards. Horse billiards is a fine game. It affords good, active exercise, hilarity, and consuming excitement. It is a mixture of hopscotch and shuffleboard played with a crutch. A large hopscotch diagram is marked out on the deck with chalk, and each compartment numbered. You stand off 3 or 4 steps, with some broad wooden discs before you on the deck, and these you send forward with a vigorous thrust of a long crutch. If a disc stops on a chalk line, it does not count anything. If it stops in division number 7, it counts 7, in 5, it counts 5, and so on. The game is 100, and 4 can play at a time. That game would be very simple played on a stationary floor, but with us, to play it well required science. We had to allow for the reeling of the ship to the right or the left. Very often one made calculations for a heel to the right, and the ship did not go that way. The consequence was that disc missed the whole hopscotch plan a yard or two, and then there was humiliation on one side and laughter on the other. When it rained the passengers had to stay in the house, of course, or at least the cabins, and amuse themselves with games, reading, looking out of the windows at the very familiar billows, and talking gossip. By 7 o'clock in the evening, dinner was about over. An hour's promenade on the upper deck followed. Then the gong sounded and a large majority of the party repaired to the after cabin upper, a handsome saloon 50 or 60 feet long, for prayers. The unregenerated called this saloon the synagogue. The devotions consisted only of 2 hymns from the Plymouth collection and a short prayer, and seldom occupied more than 15 minutes. The hymns were accompanied by parlor organ music, when the sea was smooth enough to allow a performer to sit at the instrument without being lashed to his chair. After prayers the synagogue shortly took the semblance of a writing school. The like of that picture was never seen in a ship before. Behind the long dining tables on either side of the saloon, and scattered from one end to the other of the latter, some 20 or 30 gentlemen and ladies sat them down under the swaying lamps and for 2 or 3 hours wrote diligently in their journals. Alas! that journal so voluminously begun should come to so lame and impotent a conclusion as most of them did. I doubt if there is a single pilgrim of all that host, but can show 100 fair pages of journal concerning the first 20 days voyaging in the Quaker City, and I am morally certain that not 10 of the party can show 20 pages of journal for the succeeding 20,000 miles of voyaging. At certain periods it becomes the dearest ambition of a man to keep a faithful record of his performances in a book, and he dashes at this work with an enthusiasm that imposes on him the notion that keeping a journal is the veriest pastime in the world, and the pleasantest. But if he only lives 21 days, he will find out that only those rare natures that are made up of pluck, endurance, devotion to duty for duty's sake, and invincible determination may hope to venture upon so tremendous an enterprise as the keeping of a journal, and not sustain a shameful defeat. One of our favorite youths, Jack, a splendid young fellow with a head full of good sense, and a pair of legs that were a wonder to look upon in the way of length and straightness and slimness, used to report progress every morning in the most glowing and spirited way, and say, "Oh, I'm coming along, bully." He was a little given to slang in his happier moods. "Wrote 10 pages in my journal last night, and you know I wrote 9 the night before, and 12 the night before that. Why, it's only fun." "What do you find to put in it, Jack?" "Oh, everything. Latitude and longitude, noon every day, and how many miles we made last 24 hours, and all the domino games I beat and horse billiards, and whales and sharks and porpoises, and the text of the sermon Sundays because that'll tell at home, you know, and the ships we saluted, and what nation they were, and which way the wind was, and whether there was a heavy sea, and what sail we carried, though we don't ever carry any, principally, going against a head wind always wonder what is the reason of that. And how many lies Molt has told, oh, everything. I've got everything down. My father told me to keep that journal. Father wouldn't take $1,000 for it when I get it done. No, Jack, it will be worth more than $1,000 when you get it done. Do you? No, but do you think it will, though? Yes, it will be worth at least as much as $1,000 when you get it done. Maybe more. Well, I about half think so, myself. It ain't no slouch of a journal. But it shortly became a most lamentable louch of a journal. One night in Paris, after a hard day's toil in sightseeing, I said, "Now I'll go and stroll around the cafes a while, Jack, and give you a chance to write up your journal, old fellow." His countenance lost its fire. He said, "Well, no, you needn't mind. I think I won't run that journal anymore. It is awful tedious. Do you know, I reckon I'm as much as 4,000 pages behindhand. I haven't got any France in it at all. First I thought I'd leave France out and start fresh. But that wouldn't do, would it? The governor would say, 'Hello, here, didn't see anything in France?' That cat wouldn't fight, you know. First I thought I'd copy France out of the guidebook, like old Badger in the forward cabin, who's writing a book, but there's more than 300 pages of it. Oh, I don't think a journal's any use, do you? They're only a bother, ain't they?" "Yes, a journal that is incomplete isn't of much use, but a journal properly kept is worth $1,000 when you've got it done." "$1,000? Well, I should think so. I wouldn't finish it for $1,000,000. His experience was only the experience of the majority of that industrious night school in the cabin. If you wish to inflict a heartless and malignant punishment upon a young person, pledge him to keep a journal a year. A good many expedients were resorted to keep the excursionists amused and satisfied. A club was formed, of all the passengers, which met in the writing school after prayers, and read aloud about the countries we were approaching, and discussed the information so obtained. Several times the photographer of the expedition brought out his transparent pictures, and gave us a handsome magic lantern exhibition. His views were nearly all of foreign scenes, but there were one or two home pictures among them. He advertised that he would pen his performance in the after cabin at 2 bells 9 p.m. and show the passengers where they shall eventually arrive, which was all very well, but by a funny accident the first picture that flamed out upon the canvas was a view of Greenwood Cemetery. On several starlight nights we danced on the upper deck, under the awnings, and made something of a ballroom display of brilliancy by hanging a number of ship's lanterns to the stanchions. Our music consisted of the well-mixed strains of a melodeon which was a little asthmatic, and apt to catch its breath, where it ought to come out strong, a clarinet which was a little unreliable on the high keys, and rather melancholy on the low ones, and a disreputable accordion, that had a leak somewhere, and breathed louder than it squawked. A more elegant term does not occur to me just now. However, the dancing was infinitely worse than the music. When the ship rolled to starboard, the whole platoon of dancers came charging down to starboard with it, and brought up in mass at the rail, and when it rolled to port they went floundering down to port with the same unanimity of sentiment. Waltzers spun around precariously for a matter of 15 seconds, and then went scurrying down to the rail, as if they meant to go overboard. The Virginia reel, as performed on board the Quaker City, had more genuine reel about it than any reel I ever saw before, and was as full of interest to the spectator as it was full of desperate chances and hairbreadth escapes to the participant. We gave up dancing, finally. We celebrated a lady's birthday anniversary with toasts, speeches, a poem, and so forth. We also had a mock trial. No ship ever went to sea that hadn't a mock trial on board. The purser was accused of stealing an overcoat from stateroom number 10. A judge was appointed. Also clerks, a crier of the court, constables, sheriffs, counsel for the state, and for the defendant. Witnesses were subpoenaed, and a jury empaneled after much challenging. The witnesses were stupid and unreliable and contradictory, as witnesses always are. The counsel were eloquent, argumentative, and vindictively abusive of each other, as was characteristic and proper. The case was at last submitted, and duly finished by the judge with an absurd decision and a ridiculous sentence. The acting of charades was tried on several evenings by the young gentlemen and ladies, in the cabins, and proved the most distinguished success of all the amusement experiments. An attempt was made to organize a debating club, but it was a failure. There was no oratorical talent in the ship. We all enjoyed ourselves, I think I can safely say that, but it was in a rather quiet way. We very, very seldom played the piano. We played the flute and the clarinet together, and made good music to what there was of it, but we always played the same old tune. It was a very pretty tune, how well I remember it, I wonder when I shall ever get rid of it. We never played either the melodeon or the organ except at devotions, but I am too fast. Young Albert did know part of a tune, something about oh something or other, how sweet it is to know that he's his, what's his dash name?
I do not remember the exact title of it, but it was very plaintive and full of sentiment.
Albert played that pretty much all the time until we contracted with him to restrain himself. But nobody ever sang by moonlight on the upper deck, and the congregational singing at church and prayers was not of a superior order of architecture. I put up with it, as long as I could, and then joined in and tried to improve it, but this encouraged young George to join in too, and that made a failure of it, because George's voice was just earning, and when he was singing a dismal sort of bass it was apt to fly off the handle, and startle everybody with a most discordant cackle on the upper notes. George didn't know the tunes either, which was also a drawback to his performances. I said, "Come now, George, don't improvise. It looks too egotistical. It will provoke remark. Just stick to coronation, apostrophe like the others. It is a good tune, you can't improve it any, just offhand, in this way.
Why, I'm not trying to improve it, and I am singing like the others, just as it is in the notes. And he honestly thought he was too. And so he had no one to blame but himself, when his voice caught on the center occasionally, and gave him the lockjaw. There were those among the unregenerated who attributed the unceasing headwinds to our distressing choir music. There were those who said openly that it was taking chances enough to have such ghastly music going on, even when it was at its best, and that to exaggerate the crime by letting George help was simply flying in the face of Providence. They said that the choir would keep up their lacerating attempts at melody until they would bring down a storm someday that would sink the ship. There were even grumblers at the prayers. The executive officer said the pilgrims had no charity. There they are, down there every night at 8 bells, praying for fair winds when they know as well as I do that this is the only ship going east this time of the year, but there's 1,000 coming west. What's a fair wind for us is a headwind to them. The Almighty's blowing a fair wind for 1,000 vessels, and this tribe wants him to turn it clear around so as to accommodate one, and she a steamship at that. It ain't good sense, it ain't good reason, it ain't good Christianity, it ain't common human charity. Avast with such nonsense. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.